Hello and welcome to the Diversity in Research podcast. I'm Lachlan Smith.
And I am Jakob Filfus Christensen.
This is the first episode of season two of our podcast. We've made it. We've made it to season two.
Yay!
We weren't sure where this journey was going to take us, but we've got some fantastic guests lined up in season two, and it's great to be back. The last couple of months have been really busy. The world continues to evolve and change, and COVID hasn't gone away, and the impacts of that continue to evolve and change as well. So there's lots to talk about potentially going forward as new research streams come online and new research programs come online. But today we've got our guest is Laura Evans from Nifty Fox, and Laura's going to talk a little bit about that. But in summary, she started her career in HE, but now works outside of HE, working with researchers to help them find creative ways to tell their research stories and to drive impact. And Laura's got a really interesting perspective as somebody who's worked within HE but now works with HE and is also a member of the LGBT community. And we hope you enjoy our interview with Laura. Hi, and welcome, Laura, to the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
That's great. Just to kick us off, I thought you could tell us a little bit about your route into HE. You know, what roles did you undertake when you were working in HE? How did that come about? And then eventually, how did you end up in the role that you have now as a freelancer and running your own business?
That's a very good question, one that I ask myself every day, to be honest, as to how I've ended up here. So I did my degree in sociology and then did a master's in social research. And then rather than going down the PhD route, I decided to get a job straight after my master's because I was poor and I needed to fund being a human. So I got my first job working on research into volunteering and how that equates to graduate employability. So how do students volunteering during their degree improve their graduate outcomes? And I did that for about a year, 18 months. And then I moved roles and universities there to widening participation. So my next three roles at differing universities across the UK were about looking at the barriers to entry to higher education for those from disadvantaged backgrounds. And lots of discrete research projects around admissions and admissions processes and also retention. So when we get the students from these backgrounds into unis, how on earth do we keep them? And what are the kind of the almost institutional barriers that are preventing people remaining in higher education? Yep. So I did all of that for 6-7 years. And then about 4 years ago, I left HE. So my hand was slightly forced, so I had some health issues, which meant I had to leave my job. But actually, yeah. I think some of those health issues were around being inauthentic and kind of experiencing a bit of burnout in my role and having to juggle being a young manager, dealing with a lot of institutional rubbish and trying to just navigate life as a late 20-something that's trying desperately to be a good LGBT person. But the only way for me to do that, I felt, in the context I was in, was to deny that.
Right.
So my hand was forced, but then when it came to the point of view of what do I do next, I tried to sort of think strategically about, well, what knowledge do I have? What are my skill sets and how can I change the world with them? And one of the things that kept coming up was just being really frustrated with the way HE and academia communicate with the layperson. And a lot of that was based on my experience as an LGBT person, because I felt like I was never, especially in a research space, never identified or never spoken to. Like our identity was completely invisible. So Nifty Fox was born out of this frustration of, well, why do we use loads of long words and jargon all the time? There's got to be a better way. And a lot of the latter part of my career was a lot more in visual communication, co-production of research. How can we use visual methods to actually level the knowledge playing field and challenge what knowledge is and how, you know, how do we decide what knowledge is useful? Yeah. And then some very lovely people started paying me to do it. And 4 years later, here we are with, you know, lots of universities on our books, a growing team, as well as the NHS, Public Health England, and lots of other name dropping, which I'll stop doing now.
That's brilliant. So it sounds like you weren't out then when you were working at universities. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so I was just chatting to my partner about this before we've chatted. So I was eventually out in all of my roles, but it probably right. took 6 months at least for me to feel comfortable enough to come out. Right. Especially though, the first two of the four, I felt quite like I needed to be closeted for a while.
Okay.
The latter two, especially my final role but before I left HE, I made the effort to be, I was probably not out, not by deliberate choice. Let's put it that way. No, let me rephrase that. It was, I didn't deny my sexuality. If somebody asked me about my partner, I would tell them, but I wasn't openly kind of wearing my rainbow lanyard, shouting it from the rooftops. Yeah. That was probably the only role where I was kind of open in that sense. But the others I felt, I was quite closeted,
And was that did you see that as a kind of a cultural thing within the teams you're working in, or was that partly about where you were at as an individual in your life? Was it a mixture of both or something else?
I think it was a mixture of both. I think partly was where I was at with my kind of coming out journey. I mean, I was out to my family and friends when I was about 20, 21.
Yeah.
But I think it took me a long time to be okay with it myself. So, you know, it's hard to walk the walk when you're not sure what the walk is. And then I was also at the beginning of those roles kind of just coming out of quite an unhealthy relationship. So I didn't really associate my lesbianness with much positivity at that point. But then meeting my current partner, who I'm hopefully getting married to next year. We've been together 9 years now. When I met Steph, then my kind of personal relationship with my identity sort of started to change into something that is, because Steph's very vocal and very out, and that reflected on me. And I thought, well, actually, why am I doing this? And from an institutional point of view, it's kind of all those microaggressions that made me bite my lip. So there was never any overt homophobia, but it was all of that kind of heteronormativity, the assumptions that you're straight, and, you know, those the banter in the staff room, or, you know, especially within certain academic departments, it felt quite unsafe to come out.
Right.
But again, I think now, being in my 30s, I would completely relate to that situation differently. And stand up a little bit more, because I think it takes people to be seen in order for these microaggressions to be challenged. So I deal with it differently, but that's why at the time I felt like I needed to keep shtum, shall we say.
And when you did come out in each of those roles, or when it became, I guess, common knowledge within your team or whatever it might be, did that change the way you worked? I presume you felt better about your work, but perhaps you weren't as authentic as you'd hoped to be?
Yeah, I think it's almost like jumping off a cliff in many ways, because you wonder what will catch you. So I think initially I was probably still quite scared, because I was thinking, are they treating me differently? Oh my God, are they judging everything I do? And actually that's not a reflection of the institution or the people I work with. It was about me.
Yes.
But then I definitely found that, especially as I got older, and I do think age and experience plays a factor, I just did better work because I could bring that lens, that understanding of being an LGBT plus person, to the research that I was doing. Especially when we were looking at people from disadvantaged backgrounds, and the LGBT community are within that trope. So
yeah,
I think it helped me stop hiding that and start to use that empathy to be a better researcher. And I think denying that part of me meant that I wasn't looking at all angles of a project that I could potentially have been doing prior to that. I hope that answers the question.
No, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned earlier the fact that you didn't feel like the LGBT community was sort of spoken to in research settings, by researchers. And you also talked about the fact that some of those roles within HE were within widening participation.
Mm.
And you'd like to think there'd be some marry up between the LGBT community and widening participation, but because presumably the widening participation teams looked at these issues through an EDI type of lens. And did you feel like within those circumstances, before we start talking about research a bit later on, did you feel like within those circumstances the LGBT community was kind of missed out, even through widening participation?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, again, it was a sign of that particular time, in that probably, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, to some extent, there were bigger, in the widening participation agenda, there were bigger, more important groups to be looking at. So those, you know, care leavers, the kind of BAME backgrounds. And so it was almost like, oh, this other, you know, we know LGBT is important, but not as important as these other, you know, more obvious identities, should we say. And so it's hard for me to answer that diplomatically, because I think I carry a lot of anger around the fact that I feel like LGBT young people were really missed out. But, you know, my experience of going to university, I was not out to anybody at that point. And if I'd felt like I'd been recognised, or at least mentioned, and not just in this tokenistic, oh, we have a pride society. Yeah, that's not going to make me feel welcome in any way. So yes, but no. Definitely a reference, but there was no, you know, concerted effort to communicate in any meaningful way with people from those backgrounds.
Yeah. No, and I think one of the things we have often discussed, and also with other people on the podcast, is the fact that universities, and that is not a UK thing, I think it's a global thing, at least a European thing, is that universities as institutions are incredibly conservative and slow moving, and it reflects into the organization and the research that is conducted as well, and how you interact with the employees, even if these employees are all part of a society outside university that is moving a lot faster in every way. It's a bit of a conundrum of how that is, what dynamics is at play there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I appreciate what you say about people in a work context are completely different to how they are externally, I think. And it's even when you go into that bubble of an institution, I found myself becoming more conservative. And, you know, I was very out and very open outside of work. And it just felt like you walk through those kind of ivory tower doors and you're like, oh, just everything about me has to disappear now. And even people I work with, there are people that I saw out of work with my partner who must have realised, like, oh, you know, shit, Laura's gay, but just never asked me about it or mentioned it or referenced it. And it's just bizarre because, you know, universities are meant to be this hub of liberalism and really, you know, forward-thinking people, but it's not at the same time, if I'm brutally honest.
No, and I also, we have just been through the European Research and Innovations Days, and as you talk about communication, research communication, what we heard a lot of time is that they talk about engaging the public, engaging society, and one of the other things is, can we both talk about these things in the singular and talk about diversity?
That is a good question. It's what, especially with, I resonate with what you're saying there about kind of public engagement and how we measure impact within research as well. And you're right that these generic ideas about what is public, what is society, can we be more specific than that? And I think, especially with a lot of the researchers I work with now in my current role, where I'm helping them demonstrate their impact and communicate to lay audiences with a, you know, a small a, in that we're trying to be very specific with who we're talking to. And it's still, I think there's still this perception that, you know, if anybody listens, we've done an all right job with our research. Well, actually, you've just spent the last 5 years researching LGBT staff networks, for example. So shouldn't we be talking to LGBT people about this rather than anybody who will happen to look at my tweet? And it's a real challenge. I don't think you can talk about them in singular. I think we need to be more targeted in our research communications for audiences who might not have a voice or might not be being spoken to directly. Because we see the word society or public and instantly think, well, white middle class person, then probably European. So I think we need to be more specific in the impact agenda, definitely, on who we need to talk to and why. And but then also the other side of that is the co-production of research. Again, we a lot of, you know, kind of white middle class academics are out there telling the world what should happen, when actually we need to be involved in these communities that the research is about. So and I think it's about how we can be more diverse in those conversations too.
Agreed. And I think, you know, you're now in a unique position because you worked within HE for a few years and now you sit outside of HE, but you're still working with HE. So you're working with lots of different universities, you said, and other research organisations like the National Health Service here in the UK. But do you think being outside of HE and now working with them on a daily basis has given you a different perspective on some of the EDI challenges that perhaps might go unnoticed at a local level?
Yeah, I think so, because being an external person when you're working with any organisation, but especially in the HE, you can get away with asking challenging questions. So I've found in a lot of the comms that I do, I ask the awkward question of, well, where are LGBT people in this research? You know, the deliberate question of how can we represent LGBT plus people in this comms? Because there's always this, researchers are obsessed with being diverse and inclusive, and we need to make sure we have a range of ethnicities and a range of abilities. And I'm like, well, what about a range of sexualities and genders then? How do we represent that then? So it's interesting in that it's, again, something that they understand but isn't necessarily thought of in the first instance. But what's also been interesting is to see, because I now work with lots of LGBT plus researchers who I would never have known were LGBT plus unless I... hadn't been open in my calls with all my clients. Now I regularly mention my other half and the LGBT stuff I'm working on. So it's been interesting for me to see how many researchers go, oh, like me too. And then we start to talk about their experience in academia. And I'm thinking, yeah, I experienced the same isolation and kind of fear. So it seems that being an external person, I see these identities that are often completely invisible in the academic world. But it all, because of my identity, I also try and I was going to use the word force, but gently coax is probably the right word, my clients to start seeing things through a more EDI lens. It's got better. They're definitely more aware of how to communicate with audiences that don't fit into their ideal box. But again, it's still something they haven't considered until I raise it. So, and there's also this, I know you were talking about kind of internationalisation when we were chatting before, and there are some really interesting tensions between research projects that span lots of countries, some of which don't necessarily have the best LGBT plus rights and laws. And that has been challenging for me personally to navigate, because whilst my British counterpart knows all about my history and I'm getting married and all of this, my Nigerian counterpart has no idea. And that affects the way I work with that particular part of the clientele, but also how they can engage with me and do a good job too. So I think it's finding the balance between being this kind of external voice that's going, hey, have you considered anything relating to EDI or LGBT plus issues? But also representing myself authentically without endangering my relationship with the client. And it's such a weird tension-filled relationship. I did go off on a tangent there. Yeah.
No, it is. And you raise an important point. And we've talked about this before on one other podcast in particular. We're looking at university policies around LGBT travel here in the UK, but what you describe resonates with me. I've travelled to and worked in countries which don't have good LGBT records, human rights records, and don't have accommodating laws. And, you know, I've had to go into those situations with a pre-prepared script effectively in my head in terms of what do I say if people ask if I'm married or have a girlfriend or have kids or whatever the question might be? And do you find yourself thinking about those sorts of things in you know, what if you are asked, how are you going to manage that relationship?
Yeah, it's the challenge for me is managing my sometimes quite exuberant personality and very openness about it with my also perpetual need to be safe and also protect my business. Because, you know, if I cheese off a member of the research team, that can be potentially damaging for Nifty Fox. So, having pre-prepared scripts is really difficult. And I try, and my line in this situation is I answer the questions as honestly as possible without being gender or pronoun specific. So I've had it before where people have noticed my engagement ring and they've said, oh, you know, are you looking forward to marrying your future husband? And I thought, how do I correct you, or do I just let you think that, but I'm not lying by just going, I don't have the right, a hard and fast answer to that, other than I think as many LGBT plus people, and I'm speaking for many people here when I shouldn't be, but I think we all get quite good at navigating where we feel safe or not, and when coming out is appropriate and when it isn't. So I think I normally in those situations go with, I don't lie, but I omit the truth. I would feel the need to, I think I would feel the need to answer the question as politely and as non-specifically as possible, or completely change the subject. I think as I'm getting older, my need to push against that becomes greater because it feels inauthentic. So I think it's so hard because there are times when I think if I had really good relationships with the other members of a research team or even the person that I'm talking to, who might be from a country that's slightly less culturally aware of LGBT plus rights and people, I think I probably would now go, well, actually, my other half is a female and I'm gay, and I appreciate that might be difficult for you, but I want you to be able to ask me questions about it, and I'd love to hear what you think. And so I think it's two-way.
Yeah.
I have to offer that information in order for them to have the opportunity to change their view.
And the problem with omitting the truth is that the longer you wait, the more difficult it becomes and the more awkward it becomes.
Yeah.
So you always want to do it as soon as possible when you're not entirely sure you're feeling safe yet. And so you live in that constant tension until you're through it, and it's right. It with age, it becomes a greater need often to have that, because you just can't cope with that tension anymore. It's just so tiresome.
Yeah.
Believe me, having been married for 10 years with Victor Marsman, it's like, I don't know, want to lie about him anymore. It's just, but how have you, sorry.
No, go on. No, I was only going to make a joke, but even I find it difficult even in the UK to decide where coming out is appropriate or not. Like, my hairdresser still thinks I'm getting married to a guy called Stephen next year. Because I just haven't got the gumption to be like, do you know what? Actually, I've been seeing you for 6 years, but I'm massively gay. And but it's weird, those because you walk into a really heteronormative space with all of these very heterosexual people, and you just feel like, shit, like I can't let the guard down.
And also sometimes if you come out, it feels like you are unnecessarily, more or less, fighting the fight. And you don't want to. It's like, no, I'm not trying to push some sort of agenda. I just want to be free and be who I am. Have you, with the researchers you have talked about with these topics, have you seen anywhere where they had any kind of institutional support in navigating these questions?
No. I think they might have done, but they were definitely didn't have an institutional steer on what the right thing to do is.
No.
And I think, you know, my master's thesis actually weirdly was on institutionalized homophobia. And so again, is a mission of LGBT plus issues within institutional policy, is, you know, can that be deemed as homophobia or just a mission? So no is the honest answer to that. At no point did they, I think a lot of the research that I work with have very strong personal, you know, policies, and their funders will have things that they want to adhere to, but rarely does that include, from my knowledge anyway, rarely does that include any, you know, not just LGBT plus issues, but explicit EDI stuff. That's not to say that aren't there, but yeah, I mean, even when I worked in HE, there isn't a kind of a nice manual to go to of how to deal with, you know, LGBT plus employment issues or anything like that. And because my partner is in HR at a very big organization and private sector, you know, they're really forward thinking. There's, you know, trans policies and really, really well thought out, really considered LGBT plus policy, and a really active staff network that doesn't feel tokenistic. Whereas in HE, if I compare that to the people I work with now and also my own experience, that level of kind of business savvy over an employment and a people issue just isn't there yet. And I'm speaking very generally, so there might be pockets out there that I'm not aware of, but I think in everything that universities do, and I can say this as an external person, I feel like they're catching up with the rest of the world, the rest of society, as we've said before. And it's the same with comms and what I do. You know, what I do isn't rocket science. It's just I've read some marketing books and done my research, and I know how you can do stuff better. And I feel like, you know, especially HE institutions could really do with a bit more training, awareness, looking at how the private sector are doing things, because there are some really great examples of where, you know, inclusion and belonging, as it's often called now, is far more written into the fabric of what they do generally. And I don't think there's that institutional representation at university level yet of this is how we operate, and, you know, inclusion and diversity and equality is built into that. I've not seen that yet.
No, and I think you're right, and also with the belonging and how it's about changing cultures, because as you said in the beginning, it isn't because you have witnessed institutionalized or open homophobia. It is the banter with colleagues and stuff like that, and the microaggressions, and you need a different kind of tool to manage that instead of just a broad institutional policy on this topic.
And it's how do you, I mean, like, you could have the policy, but then it's how it's that's enacted in everyday life, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, I've not been in HE institutions in a very long time, but I've not been in them as the closeted person. So my experience of it, because people know my sexuality, may act very differently around me. So I think it's interesting to be a fly on the wall now, rather than having to sort of wade through the muddy waters of do I come out, do I not, do I challenge that person using the word gay in a derogatory way without seeming like I'm making a big deal out of it or being way too politically correct. So I'm kind of relieved that I don't have to navigate that environment anymore, because I have the power now to, if you don't like the fact that, you know, I'm a lesbian, then I don't have to work with you, and you don't have to work with me. So screw you.
So speaking of your work, I mean, you touched on it, you know, you help academics, universities translate research into, I don't know, accessible, simple messages. I've seen the work you do. I've been involved in a conference where you were doing that work. It's fascinating to watch as you go through that process and create visual aids. I don't know how I'll let you describe what you do better than I can, but, you know, have you found that working with different universities when it comes to issues around EDI, is it varied across the universities? Do disciplines vary as well? Does it make a difference whether it's engineering or a medicine or a sociology? What's your experience like with that and what you do on a day-to-day basis now?
So if I go back to the first part, so what I do now, so I work with academics in the public sector to help them tell their stories visually so that audiences listen. That sounded very beautifully pre-prepared pitched, but there we go. So basically I take their research and turn it into really simple messages and visual communication. So we call it visual stories to help people outside of academia and even in academia understand what the bloody hell they've been doing for 5 years and why they should and what they need to do about it. And so in doing that, I obviously work with a lot of institutions, and I would actually say that EDI issues and how they deal with them is far more dependent on discipline than it is institution.
Right.
So I work with a lot of social scientists. They are very switched on to it. And in fact, whenever we talk about, because obviously when we're talking about stories, we're talking about characters. And when we're looking at personas, including audience personas, they're very switched on to different backgrounds and more overtly LGBT plus people. So I'd have to do less prompting of that when I'm working with social scientists. Also, arts and humanities are pretty good at that. When it comes to the more physical sciences, not saying everybody, but there's more of a learning curve of, well, why are we putting this particular character in, or why are we saying that? In fact, I think did a public health campaign recently that looked at, it was saying, talking about chronic pain, and it said it affects, it doesn't matter if, you know, what gender you are or what ethnicity you are. And I said, oh, I think we need to add sexuality onto that, and got real pushback going, well, why would that make any difference? Like, because it's a really important characteristic that, you know, a lot of the population will want to be hearing in that list. Yeah. And, you know, and that I kind of gave my argument by using my own background and saying, look, you're trying to speak to everybody from, you're being very pointed about other characteristics. So why can't we add this? And it was a bit more of a fight than I anticipated, but it's interesting how, you more kind of engineering, mathsy, physical sciences people find those conversations harder to have. They will have them, but they're slightly less switched on to EDI being something important to think about when you're communicating your research, because, you know, it's far more about, well, where's this in the research about, you know, DNA or theory of relativity or whatever. Terrible examples, but it's showing them that there's a different lens that you need to look at your research through. And because they've employed me to do that anyway, I kind of get away with that challenge, but it's definitely more discipline dependent, I think, than institution.
That's fascinating.
Just a quick good story on that, and that the episode we had on LGBT researchers and travel, Cameron and
Francis,
yes, their research actually came from some STEM people who had contacted them and said, we think we have to do something because we see so few out LGBT persons in the STEM world, and we think they are there, and we think we have to do something and develop some policies and see what the problems are for them to be open and to attract the right people. And it was just so nice to hear that there is that awareness and people doing some stuff, and that actually led to a broader perspective on some things.
And just to add to that too, I think there's a really keen and mobilised group of early career researchers, especially within STEM. So we've got our PhD students, because I recently spoke at a diversity in STEM event to lots of STEM early career researchers, master students, PhD students, who were just so overwhelmed that there were people like them in STEM. And I do feel like that tide is shifting, and that those in STEM are beginning to kind of shout about, well, actually, hey, we are here, and we've been here forever, and we're doing all these great things. And it was a really empowering event that was run by University of Sheffield, I think, yeah. And their MRC students set that up, and they have their own group now called Diversity in STEM. So I do think that is changing, and but it's coming from the younger academic audience that are starting to push these issues. And I think, you know, if we have this conversation again in 10 years' time, maybe even 5 years' time, that kind of institutional recognition of LGBT plus identities in a formal way will start to move forwards. But because we've got this younger group of fresh-faced academics that are from a completely different cultural generation now, so.
And that's been reflected in other interviews we've done over the series. You know, people talk about the fact that change is coming from both, as you say, younger academics, but also students, and even at undergraduate level. You know, the swell of opinion is changing, and that puts pressure on institutions and academics to change as well. But picking up your point around disciplines, you know, in other work that I've done, I've worked with academics on grant writing, securing funding, and the whole idea of sort of impact and what communities might either want to engage or be engaged by your research. It's the same challenges, you know, around STEM versus the social sciences. And when I've done the work with people in the more physical or hard sciences, I, you know, always say to them that whatever their research is, it's people who are going to deal with the outcome of your research at the end of the day. It's going to impact on people somehow. And it might be very specific groups of people, or it might be a general population, but you need to think about those people and include them in your thinking. And that normally leads to some quite interesting discussions. You know, you will still get disagreement and pushback, but you've opened the door then to those conversations, which I think is really important. Incredibly important. One of the things that we wanted to try and do through this podcast is speak to research managers as well as the people doing research, because we think it's incredibly important that research managers play a role and research administrators play a role in EDI, but also that the structures within universities around research management actually reflect society and reflect the researchers that they're supporting. So we think research management should be more diverse, and we're going to be having a chat with Arma later in this season of the podcast around the work that they're doing. But we just wondered if you had any thoughts on, you know, how you think research management can be made more diverse, and why it's important. And do you work much with the research support and research management side in the work that you do?
Yeah, so let's start with what I think can be done. I think a point I made in one of my presentations to the Diversity in STEM group was that we need to create spaces for people to learn rather than soapboxes to preach from. So I think from a research management point of view, I don't think you can force any kind of EDI agenda on anybody, no matter how morally right it is. But I think what research managers would do well to do is to try and create these spaces and this kind of culture of openness and authenticity, rather than specifically about LGBT plus. It's about how can I support my my research teams, and also make my projects, how can I support them to be the best version of themselves? And in doing so, that will then allow people to show up as their authentic LGBT plus or self, or, you know, be more open about their ethnic background and what that means to them, their religious background. So I think it's on a very base level, it's about having open conversations and creating safe space for people to do and be the very best that they can be. But I also think it's about actually supporting research projects where possible that have that LGBT plus focus. And interestingly, before we chatted today, I googled LGBT plus in academia, research on this, and there's not a lot really. So it's also about, you know, I think funders have a duty here as well to sort of start to fund research that's more specific on this topic, but also research managers to help find some of those opportunities and create some of those opportunities to do that. And I suppose within my world, it's research managers often, I often don't talk to research directly, it's the administrative staff and people around them that realise the value of this and the value of communicating effectively. And naturally, EDI comes as part of that. So I think it's also reaching out to external people like myself or even people in academia to provide some of that training and just give people opportunities to learn. So how can they create this culture of learning and authenticity and vulnerability, but not necessarily always labeling it LGBT plus, because then for some academics and for some people that will feel quite kind of divisive and quite, well, I can't go to that because I don't belong to that community. And I think if you want a stronger sense of allyship, it's just, as you were saying there, we're all people. So it's how do we get people to perform to the best of their ability? And I'm definitely of the persuasion that that's about allowing people to be vulnerable in order for them to be authentic, in order for them to do their best work. So what opportunities can, and training opportunities in particular, can those around the outside of the research, researchers doing the research itself, the people, you know, managing the budgets and the administrative side, how can they support the training side, I think? But I don't have a hard and fast answer. That's just my kind of softly approach probably to that.
No, that's great. I mean, you mentioned research funders, and I think we are starting to see a change with research funders in terms of what they expect from their researchers around EDI, making sure that research is planned, taking account of EDI, taking account both within the research teams themselves, but also the research topics. You know, what's the impact that research topic is having? And we know Horizon Europe will be looking certainly more closely at gender, but also at other protected characteristics. And there are some funders in some countries which do quite a lot around this already. And Canada is an example we often refer to, where a lot of research funders will expect a much clearer, actionable, concrete EDI assessment as part of any research funding application. So I'm encouraged that I think that is starting to change. There's still a long way to go, but perhaps we are moving in that direction.
I think it's a good way, as you said, that with Horizon Europe, that now they will have requirements on specific policies followed by resources at the institution to be allowed to apply for funding. But still, there's also something discouraging about this being a requirement in 2020, that we by 2020 still aren't even close to solving the gender gap in research. And if that is going to take so long and we are still discussing that, how on earth are we going to move on to other topics? On my bad days, that can be my take on it. It feels like we still have a long way to go, but yeah, it's good that we're seeing some initiatives.
Definitely.
Yes, we have. It's so easy to have good and then bad days when working in this kind of sphere. Yeah. Sometimes it can feel very overwhelming when you're one individual and you're trying to be your authentic self and be open and by default, I guess, change hearts and minds. And other times it feels like this is all too bloody hard. And I think we all go through that day to day sometimes. But as a final question, you know, is there anything that you think researchers from minority backgrounds can do to make their voices better heard? Is there anything you would do differently looking back on your time?
Many things. I think we talked about it earlier in that I wish, if I could have waved a magic wand, I wish that I had had the confidence to come out earlier. And be cool with that. But I think I'm hesitant to kind of tell everybody, just come out, just tell everybody all about yourself, just be the most wonderful LGBT plus version of you and people will have to deal with it, because that's not the reality for a lot of people. So I think for those that have the the safety and the comfort and are happy to do that, the more visible you are, the more it allows other people who can't be visible at that time feel like they belong. Mm. And I feel like now, if I could go back now and be that person, I feel far more of a responsibility now to be out and to be actively out as well. Mm. And be an advocate rather than just, oh, I'm an LGBT person living my life, but actually I'm an LGBT plus person living my life, but advocating for other people like me in this community so that they can live their lives too. So I think there's a responsibility for those of us that are out and feel comfortable and have that privilege to be out to start to advocate for others, not, you know, be the voice of others, but to advocate on their behalf. So I think that's that. The second one I think is actually for allies, is for, you know, allies to also step up and start to challenge some of those microaggressions I was talking about, because that's so powerful, especially when it's somebody who's not within that community, you know, realizing, hey, that's not cool actually. And I think there's that. And I think also for researchers, I think it's to start to look at topics from it through a different lens. So, you know, can we have, you know, an LGBT plus research on the coronavirus? And I'm sure there's stuff out there. And it's about how can we bring this lens and find these voices within research topics that haven't had that treatment before? Because we've seen it a lot with gender. We're seeing it more with BAME groups. But I think it would be really nice to see some more explicit LGBT plus treatments of big current events and research problems. But I think it's a really hard question, because my instant answer is start talking about it, be out, start to advocate, you know, make a noise, and let people know you're there. But I also know that that's a really hard thing to do for some people.
And perhaps to take some of the pressure, because it can easily become a lot of pressure on one person.
Yeah.
And I think to add to that is to say, yes, be open and advocate it, but also insist on it being a structural problem.
Yeah.
Not a personal problem for the individual LGBT person and the people surrounding them, but saying this is a structural problem and insist on institutional solutions to these problems and not having to fight the fight on your own every time.
That's such a good point. And I think you're right, because then it's about uniting as people again, back to we're all just people. And yes, our individual characteristics and experiences of life are important, but I think the institutions in HE have a lot more than just LGBT plus issues to start to put into policy. So I think it's about how can we you know recognize our LGBT plusness, but also recognize that this need to be seen is actually the case for a lot of different communities and identities too. So how can we work together? And you're right about not putting it on the one individual. Like, one of my faults is that I take over responsibility for everything, so I'm like, I'm just going to change the world. But actually it's, how do we create a community of people that want to do this, especially at that institutional level. I absolutely agree.
That's a very positive way to finish, I think. And it gives us something to all take away and to remember. And it is useful to remember that. I think it is a good point. You know, it's too easy to end up in that default position where we're taking it all on ourselves and trying to change the world. And we all have a part to play, but these are structural problems and we need lots of people to play their parts and not just the minority groups or the LGBT people as well. But thank you very much, Laura, for your time today. It's been great having a chat.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you. So that was our interview with Laura. A really fascinating chat. We covered lots of interesting topics there, including the fact that her hairdresser still doesn't know that she's gay and she's going to get married shortly. So we went everywhere today, absolutely everywhere, which is fantastic. Jakob, what did you take away from the interview with Laura?
I had a number of things. The first thing I I would like to highlight, as we also discussed in the episode, is the whole thing about what is it that she, what she noticed, that it is the banter. It is not that you rarely, at least today and here in the West, you rarely experience direct homophobia or harassment in any way, but it is the day-to-day banter in the office that turns you away, makes you sad, and makes you not want to or exclude yourself from the community. Yeah. And I think that's a very important point for people to realize that they unwillingly could be saying things that are excluding persons in the workplace.
Yeah, and it's come up in other podcasts as well, hasn't it? The fact that it's not always really overt and it's not always directed at you as an individual, but it can and does simmer and eat away at you. And you know, if you start hearing that banter, and Laura sort of described some of her experiences within higher education, particularly early in her career, where it just knocks your confidence, and you start to think, maybe I won't come out, or maybe I won't stand up for myself, or whatever it might be. And you're right, I think certainly in Western university cultures, it's still pretty prevalent, and people need to be mindful of that.
It is, and even sometimes it's just when the majority group talks about things that they share, and which is natural, because then you're reconfirming each other in being part of the group. But by reconfirming that to each other, you're not thinking about that. By that, you're also excluding the people who can't take part of that.
You are. That's right. I mean, there's a lot more that we could do within workplaces, and we talk about this probably every episode to ensure people understand the different perspectives that people are coming from, and that just being mindful, I guess, of those different perspectives and how they might impact on people. Yeah.
And then another thing was how she talked about the importance of being and the hardships of times of feeling like you have to be a good LGBT person. And I think that's important, because Saskia also mentioned that in the episode with her, of course, with a different perspective of race and gender, that you sometimes feel like you carry the burden of your community on your shoulders, and you have to represent them, and you don't have to them into disgrace because you're the only one from that community in the workplace, and you might give the community a bad reputation. And I don't think that other people always think about that, and of course we shouldn't. It's something we put on ourselves. It's not like everybody else does it, but I think it should be something that should be talked about more.
Yeah, and we carry that burden, and Laura talked about that you, and rightly Saskia talked about it, you have this internal conflict. A lot of people in minority groups have this internal conflict where you want to, you know, stand up for yourself, stand up for your community, ensure that there's no discrimination. But when you're sometimes the only person in that work environment or setting, it can become quite tiring and burdensome and difficult. Particularly if you don't see change, but even if you do, I think, you know, you need to protect yourself. And as communities, we need to get better at not taking that burden on always, unless we want to, and some people want to, and that's great. But that's why we need allies, and that's why you need senior leadership, and that's why you need other members of your team and institution or organization to be diverse aware and to be part of the change.
And to follow up on those two points, I think it was her talk about inclusion and belonging was very important. I think it's much in line as we talked about with how universities now not only talk about recruitment but also retention. That it's not enough to recruit some high talent from the other side of the globe. It's actually, you want to keep them there. and feel yeah. good. And that is difficult when it comes to international culture, but it's certainly also a question when it comes to other minority groups, that if you, it's not just enough to include them, you want to feel like they belong there as well.
Yeah, I found that quite a helpful distinction to make, yeah. actually. You know, I think we do get very focused on that recruitment, on making sure that your systems, processes, teams, etc., are set up to recruit diversely. But you're right, if the people then come and don't feel like they belong, then that's a challenge. And you won't retain, you know, in all likelihood, you won't retain those people. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I think, one of the points you made, which I think has echoed across other podcast episodes, is that for universities, you know, particularly here in the UK, the media talk about university being full of left-wing, loopy people who are progressive nutters and things like that. But for a lot of people who are in minorities, the lived experiences within UK universities, and I expect other universities around the world, is they're actually inherently conservative environments, and they don't, in some respects, they find it very difficult to change. And it could be quite difficult to be a minority person in those environments. And Laura's found it easier to challenge from the outside now that she's working from as a partner to researchers and to HU, although that in itself, we heard, has presented its own challenges with some international collaborations.
Yeah, I think that was a very important point to make, how she could be open with the collaborator at the UK university, but there were international collaborators that made it where she didn't feel like she could be out. And yeah. you and has telling about how that puts everybody in a strange position, not only herself, but also the UK collaborator who knows about it, and everybody seeming there thinking that she could contribute with more than she is and have different perspectives. And how does that make your relationship to the partner who I think it was in Nigeria that doesn't know about it? And I think that is, you're putting all kinds of, it just shows how complicated or complex this can be, and why you need to think about these topics beforehand, because suddenly you find yourself in a situation like this where you as a PI also working with someone like Laura has put a strain on your relationship with an academic partner suddenly, because you're lying to them. Well, not lying, but just not telling the truth.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. And Laura talked about some of her experiences of, you know, having the ability now as an external person to HE to push back and to challenge. Yeah. And sometimes that's gone well, but other times there's still questions are raised by people who don't have lived experiences of minorities, who insist that their perspectives are not relevant in certain situations, despite those minorities telling them about their lived experiences to their face. It's still a challenge. It still can be a challenge.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to science communication, how you can insist that it is the science itself and not take into consideration that the communication has to be to the audience, to the target audience, and different audiences have different expectations. And you can perhaps say in a strictly scientific sense that it isn't important or relevant, but say, no, but if you want to remain relevant to this part of the public, then adding this or that would be a good thing, and have pushbacks against that. I think it still surprises me sometimes.
Yeah, same. But clearly, it still happens. I mean, I think we just need to keep pushing, don't we? We need to keep pushing the other way.
Yeah, yeah. And the good thing, of course, is that as long as there's some that sort of pushback, there's still work for us to do. So.
Indeed. We're going to have more of these conversations, I think, aren't we? Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that was a brilliant chat with Laura. We will put Laura's details in the podcast information, so you can check out her work.
Yeah, and follow Nifty Fox on Twitter, etc. They have some interesting things out there the web.
She does some really creative and fascinating work, and I am sure that her hairdresser is very soon going to find out that she's actually gay and she's getting married to a woman. And after 7 years, that wall is going to come crumbling down, but I'm sure that will go brilliantly as well.
Yeah.
We hope you've enjoyed our first episode of season 2 of the Diversity and Research podcast. If you have enjoyed it, please comment and like and review wherever you listen to podcasts, and do check out our Twitter feed, even, which is at divrespod, divrespod.
Please share this episode and other episodes with colleagues and friends and collaborators around the world, do tell us if you have suggestions for new podcast guests that we should reach out to and have on the podcast.
And if you want to be on the podcast yourself, get in touch. We know we've got some listeners from lots of different parts of the world where we know we don't have personal connections, but if you're out there listening to us and you think you've got a story to tell around internationalization and diversity and higher education research, then get in touch.
Yep. See you soon.
See you soon. Cheers. Bye-bye.